From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, an acting lesson in performing Shakespeare from one of the most respected voice teachers of our time, Patsy Rodenberg. Her new book, Speaking Shakespeare, is addressed to actors preparing for roles. Some of the actors she's coached are Ralph Fiennes, Judi Dench, and Daniel Day-Lewis. She's director of voice at London's National Theatre. Also, we talk with New York Police Detective Dave Fitzpatrick. After the second plane struck on September 11th, he flew above Manhattan in a police helicopter, documenting the disaster below. His photos are collected in the new book, Above Hallowed Ground. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the effect of September 11th on our language. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The FBI is warning police and utility officials to be on the lookout for terrorist threats connected with the September 11th anniversary. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The FBI has sent out two alerts. One went to police via a law enforcement communication system, another through the National Infrastructure Protection Center. Both alerted authorities that the FBI continues to receive a large volume of threats, some making reference to the 9/11 observances in New York City and Washington, D.C. But the FBI says it has no firm information about attacks planned for the anniversary. But the FBI notes that a large number of high-profile events fall in September. In addition to the 9/11 events, New York will be hosting the UN General Assembly September 10th through 20th. The World Bank and the International Monetary Fund meet in Washington September 25th through the 29th. All represent attractive targets for terrorists. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush visited Detroit today, joining with Canadian Prime Minister Jean Chrétien to highlight cross-border security and hold private talks on the Bush administration's call for military action against Iraq. The two leaders said their governments have tightened security at border crossings without hampering trade between the two nations. White House spokesman Ari Fleischer said the president didn't ask Chrétien to take any specific action regarding Iraq and didn't get any commitment from the prime minister. Afterward, Chrétien said he told the president that the U.S. should work through the United Nations before taking any other action. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat denounced suicide attacks against Israeli civilians today, and he renewed his call for Palestinian elections in January. Arafat spoke before the first gathering of the Palestinian Legislative Council in 18 months. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Arafat didn't call for an end to suicide bombings, but he did argue that such attacks have been used by others to brand all Palestinians as terrorists and to, in his words, cover up the reoccupation of Palestinian cities and the killing of civilians by Israeli soldiers. Arafat called for a political solution to what he called the Iraqi problem and said international observers are needed to oversee Palestinian elections. Lawmakers were disappointed by what some called a lack of specifics in Arafat's address. The legislative session will continue, with lawmakers getting a long-awaited chance to grill Arafat's new cabinet members about their reforms. 26 legislators participated by video link from Gaza after Israel denied 12 lawmakers travel permits, claiming past involvement in terrorist attacks. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Ramallah.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 92 points, or 1%, to close at 8,519 in active trading of 1.1 billion shares. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 9 points to close at 1,304. The S&P 500 gained 9 points, or 1%, to close at 902. This is NPR News. A grand jury in Detroit has indicted pro basketball player Chris Webber on charges that he lied about taking money from a basketball booster when he was an amateur playing for the University of Michigan. Webber's now a forward for the Sacramento Kings. The player's father and his aunt were also indicted. Former Michigan Wolverines booster Ed Martin pleaded guilty to money laundering in May. He said he loaned $280,000 to Webber, as well as similar loans to three other Michigan basketball players. Parts of Colorado remain under a flood watch as heavy rains send mud and debris cascading into homes. The homes are located in mountainous areas where large wildfires burned earlier this summer. Eric Whitney reports from member station KSUT.
At least 17 counties in Colorado are under a flash flood watch as an unusually wet storm moves slowly across the state. Several of the counties are those where the huge Hayman Fire burned in June and July. Fire-scarred soils on hills where vegetation burned off are especially susceptible to creating hazardous mud and debris flows. The southwestern part of the state was hit with flash floods over the weekend, as just over an inch of rain that fell on a burned area near the city of Durango washed out roads and filled at least a dozen homes with mud, large rocks, and other debris. Several families sought shelter with the Red Cross. For NPR News, I'm Eric Whitney in Durango, Colorado.
The State Department says Colombia has improved its record on human rights. The certification clears the way for Colombia to receive more than $41 million in U.S. military aid. Amnesty International disputes the certification, saying the Colombian military is still working with paramilitary militias. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM, the nature of what's to come, at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Radio has taught me that you can learn a lot about a person by listening to his or her voice, the amount of tension in the voice, the range of notes that are sounded when the person speaks, and the rhythms of their speech. Many actors, as well as other people who use their voices professionally, from teachers to politicians, have studied with my guest Patsy Rodenberg to learn how to free the voice and use it in the most expressive way. Rodenberg is one of the world's leading voice and acting coaches. She's the director of voice at London's National Theatre and the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Ian McKellen, Ray Fiennes, and Ian Holm are some of the actors who have studied with Rodenberg. Her new book, Speaking Shakespeare, offers her advice to actors preparing to perform Shakespeare roles. She says Shakespeare requires a speaking style that's different from contemporary speech. I asked her to describe some of the differences.
Well, I suppose in the big picture, I don't think there is a difference if we are heightened. What I mean by that is that if we have tremendous need to speak, we are no longer casual. Our speech habits today tend to revolve around what I would call the cool, the lack of care about what you're saying. I would suggest that what Shakespeare captures in his work is the moments in our life when we have to be very formal. Now, the word formal might scare people, but what I mean by that is caring enough to speak clearly.
Yeah, you point out a lot of our communication is often indirect or casual or stumbling. You say we rely on glibness or cynicism. A lot of irony. Is that different than what you're going to find in most Shakespeare?
Well, I think he plays with those ideas, but when the temperature changes, when things become extremely important, then you have to move up a few notches and you have to choose your language very carefully and you have to speak carefully. Now, let's have an example. I mean, I was amazed, like the whole world was, on September the 11th, but one of the things that I thought was fascinating, which is what Shakespeare would pursue, is that everybody interviewed that day spoke clearly. It was too important not to witness the truth. And that's all he's asking from us. Yes, he's going to structure, he's going to use language that is very passionate and very concrete. But the first stage that a young actor has to grasp if they do Shakespeare is there is nothing casual or, back to the word, careless. Another example is that I think you wouldn't mumble in front of a tyrant. I mean, if King Lear is on stage and you're in that world, you have to speak very clearly. So he requires different speaking, but I think it's something that we can all do.
You say that in preparation for Shakespeare, you encourage your students to own what they think and say. How do you encourage them to do that?
Well, I do a series of exercises that not only opens up their voice to prove to them that they've all got fantastic voices that can actually cope with the athletic demands of a heightened classical text, but that they all do have passion. Maybe it is not fashionable for them to debate, but in fact they want to debate. And so I will give them exercises to explore how they use language when they're distressed. And often it will be very similar to the language that Shakespeare uses, the physical nature of language. If you speak something in Shakespeare, I'm just thinking of Leontes at the moment, when he discovers that he believes his wife is unfaithful to him, he starts to use very physically sensual and yet dirty language. And many a man there is, even at this present, now while I speak this, holds his wife by the arm, that little thinks she has been sluiced in his absence, and his pond fished by his next neighbour, by Sir Smile, his neighbour. You know, all that, those S's are sloshing around, and it produces something that is very disgusting in the mouth, exactly what Leontes is going through, which is the disgusting notion that his wife is sleeping with his best friend. So I would encourage students to think very accurately about the moments in their life when they've lost something. And great plays, great comedies and tragedies, in a sense, are about loss. I'm just thinking of a student at the moment, an American student, actually, that I had in London. And there's a moment when Hamlet, in his first soliloquy, of course Hamlet knows his mother is sleeping with his uncle, but he mentions that he notices her shoes. She's wearing the same shoes at the wedding that she wore at the funeral. And it's that detail that will suddenly engage a young person in understanding that Shakespeare is not difficult if you realise he's exploring the samenesses of humanity through very structured language and very concrete terms. And this particular student was very distressed because he suddenly realised that the great pain of his life up to that moment, he had just broken up with his girlfriend, and he didn't realise the pain until he saw her in the street with her new boyfriend, and the new boyfriend was wearing a jumper that he had given to her. So suddenly the detail of shoes and Hamlet suddenly spoke to him. So I would encourage not only a physical use of the body and the and language and the voice, but also the imagination, and to take them higher.
For an actor playing a leading part in a Shakespearean play, there's likely to be a soliloquy that they'll have to do. And soliloquies are not only heightened speech, but they're long speech. it's a lot to say.
It's a lot to say.
Can you give us can you tell us the kind of advice you give an actor who's setting out to learn a Shakespearean soliloquy on how to comprehend what's being said and thereby breaking it up into speech, figuring out where to breathe, what to say within each breath?
Well, before they did a soliloquy, they would have to work out their, as I said, their voice and their body, because so many people have lost the full extension of their voice. And as I said earlier, Shakespeare is athletic. So at the point when they're free enough in themselves so that they can enter the speech. So the first thing I'll do is that, and then I'll talk in terms that it's not a difficult thing to understand a Shakespeare speech if you realise that it goes in stages. It's one step. I'll tell you what it's like. It's like, do you know those wonderful Russian dolls that you open? All you have to worry about is to be or not to be. That's all you have to worry about before you get to the next thing, which is, that is the question.
So just do it so one phrase at a time.
Stage
in your mind.
By
stay in the
stage
moment.
Uh-huh. By stage. And it's not difficult then. I'll tell you what, I often watch Judge Judy. You're going to laugh at me. Because
okay,
I love Judge Judy on one level, because what she's trying to make the people in her court do is think classically, think in Shakespearean terms. That's all it is. She's asking them to say, start at the beginning. No, 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 no. Go back to the beginning. No, I've heard that bit. Move on, move on. So speech in Shakespeare constantly moves on. You say something and then you move on to the next thing and you develop an argument until you can conclude. So that's all she's asking. And in fact, that's the skill that made us the species that runs the planet, rules the planet. The moment that human beings went, what if? Which is the Shakespearean thing of this leading to this, and maybe if I think of that, I can move to that. It's not difficult. It's what we all yearn to do, and it's what we have to do to make sense of the world that we live in. So with a soliloquy, it's somebody trying to probe and penetrate a very difficult problem. It could be a comedy problem, but the actor is still worried, you know, how happy some or other some can be. This is Helena in The Dream. All she's saying to the audience is, it's not, why are some people happier than I am? And then she goes to explore that. So it's not, Shakespeare is not difficult if you just know the rules, look and actually work very clearly and concretely on the language and the forms of the language, the structures, you know.
Would you like to choose one of the soliloquies and just break it down a little bit for us?
Well, let's look at the first soliloquy of Hamlet.
Okay.
Which a lot of people are very scared of. And he starts by saying, "Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt." And that's the first line. All you have to worry about is that somebody is saying, "I want my flesh to melt." And he wants it to thaw and resolve itself into a dew. And that's the end of the first thought. And he might finish there. But he doesn't finish there. He goes on. The next stage, "Or that the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter. I could commit suicide, but I can't." And then it explodes with passion when he says, "Oh God, God, how weary, stale, flat, and unprofitable seem to me all the uses of this world." So he then does what we all know happens when we get very depressed. Nothing interests him anymore. And then he again explodes in pain. "Phiont, ah, phi. It is an unweeded garden that grows to seed. Things rank and gross in nature possess it merely." So the world, the picture he's seeing of the world at this stage is that it's just a wasteland that he doesn't want to occupy anymore, that it should come to this. And so he's starting to move towards a terrible revelation. He moves towards this terrible revelation at the end, which is this wonderful way that he uses language, Shakespeare. "Oh, most wicked speed to post with such dexterity to incestuous sheets." And suddenly, that's hard to say. So one of the great messages I'm going to say again and again to young actors is that if it's difficult to say, it's because it's difficult to think, feel or imagine. And here he has to actually, in his imagination, go into the bedroom with his mother and his uncle, and there are those awful sheets. And at the end of that soliloquy, all he has to say is, "It is not, nor it cannot come to good, but break my heart, for I must hold my tongue." And that could be the end of the play, because he's actually faced this betrayal. He says his heart is going to break and he can't speak. And at that moment, Horatio comes in and then talks about the ghost.
My guest is Patsy Rodenberg, author of the new book, Speaking Shakespeare. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is acting and voice coach Patsy Rodenberg. She's director of voice at London's National Theatre. Her new book is called Speaking Shakespeare. The structure of a lot of Shakespeare's writing is iambic pentameter. I want you to first describe what iambic pentameter is and then talk about how you recommend to actors that they approach this form.
It's a terrifying phrase, isn't it? Iambic pentameter. All it means is there are 10 syllables in a line, and the regular iambic is ba-boom, which is the heartbeat. Now, what I keep on trying to suggest to people is that Shakespeare is not that difficult if you just look and see what's there. Now, the heartbeat happens to be the first rhythm that we hear, and it's the last. It is the most potent rhythm in the human being. And he writes not an academic form, he writes a human form. And so you've got 5 major beats in a line. Now, "When I do count the clock that tells the time," that is a perfect iambic pentameter. And it's just telling about the clock ticking.
It's a ba-bum, ba-bum, ba-bum.
Ba-bum, 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 ba-bum. "When I do count the clock that tells the time, and it's perfect. But there are very few perfect lines in Shakespeare, because what he realises is that as life moves us around passionately, our heartbeat changes. So you have to understand, what I say to young actors all the time is, I don't care if anybody ever breaks a rule. What I find disturbing is when they're breaking rules without realising the rule is there. And on top of that, you are missing the most amazing acting note that somebody's heart is breaking.
Can you maybe find a couple of lines from Shakespeare in which one is in perfect iambic pentameter, but there's an irregularity in the second line, and talk about the difference in the reading that you'd give to each?
Well, Orsino in Twelfth Night opens the play. If music be the food of love, play on. That is pretty regular. If music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it, that surfeiting. And suddenly, around surfeiting, this is the second line, give me excess of it, that surfeiting. Surfeiting somehow breaks. Think about it like a wave in the sea. Suddenly, you're on a wave that's breaking. So, if music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it, that surfeiting. And suddenly you can feel. Actually, if you give Shakespeare to a child and you ask them to hum it, it might sound ridiculous. I'll do it for you. They'll immediately feel the disturbance on the word surfeiting. It's like skipping, and suddenly it's broken. And that, again, is where the word and the form meet and signal something to you. I think in many ways the earlier plays are harder to speak because he doesn't break as many rules. But a very late play, which is Winter's Tale, I talked about it earlier, but Leontes, it's chaos. There's hardly a regular verse line in the whole play because it's about a play about jealousy and sexual jealousy and the torment. So suddenly we have inch thick, knee deep, our head and ears are forked one. Inch thick, knee deep, our head and ears are forked one. It's all over the place. You're like in this very rough sea. Go, playboy, play, thy mother plays, and I play too, but so disgraced apart, whose issue will hiss me to the grave. And suddenly it's all over the place. And that's what he's doing. He's giving you a rhythm that we all understand. We all understand the heartbeat. And then he breaks it. If you trust that, you will be held by a great writer, as opposed to drown. If you don't trust it, you will not drown.
Now, what suggestions do you have to actors who are so kind of caught in their contemporary and personal style of speaking that they can't get out of that enough to get into the Shakespeare style of speaking? How do you transcend your? I mean, I guess this is an impossible question to answer.
Well, I'll have a go. I'll have a go at answering it because it's about what's great about Shakespeare. Why I want to do Shakespeare is that he's full of humanity and compassion. And my goodness, we need Shakespeare at this particular moment of time because he moves towards our full experience. So an actor that doesn't want to shift a habit is not wanting to move towards the experience of another human being. For instance, if you want to speak casually and you're in a great scene when people are talking about incredible events, then you haven't got the imagination to realise that you wouldn't dare do that in those circumstances. You know, I was working, I've been lucky enough to teach Shakespeare all over the world. You know, in Soweto, when I did Titus Andronicus with actors there, they had absolute understanding of the violence in that play because most of them had been through, in apartheid, that violence. So, in fact, to speak it was a witnessing of that violence. So, in fact, those actors had no problem in speaking Shakespeare because they had understood something about the human condition. When I was working in with actors, Bosnian actors, I had actually a young English actor with me working with these actors, and she was mumbling, And one of them turned to her and said, "My dear, if the television camera visits you and you have one moment to say, 'They shot my son under that tree and my brother was shot under that one,' you don't mumble." Do you know? And those are the issues that we're talking about in Shakespeare. You know, you would not mumble, I would hazard a guess, in front of a tyrant like Saddam Hussein, because he would look at you and probably shoot you. It's about not only craft, but about imagination, about the cost of life.
Betsy Rodenberg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Betsy Rodenberg is director of voice at London's National Theatre. Her new book is called Speaking Shakespeare. Those of us who are fans of the voice of the late singer Susanna McCorkle no longer have new sessions of hers to look forward to, but a new CD features demo recordings she made before she ever recorded professionally. These demos were made in the hopes of convincing a record company to record her. The CD is called The Beginning, 1975, Susanna McCorkle with pianist Keith Ingham. Here's a song from it, Says My Heart. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Fall in love, fall in love, says my heart. Take a chance on romance, says my heart. But each time that I'm almost in his arms, that old school teacher brain of mine keeps ringing in false alarms. So my head rules instead, and I'm wise to the scheme of that gleam in his eyes. So I kiss and run, but the moment we're apart, oh, you fool, that was love, says my heart.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Discovery Channel, presenting a documentary based on the New York Times series Portraits of Grief, Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on the Discovery Channel. And Anchor Books, publishers of Living a Life That Matters, the new paperback by Harold S. Kushner, author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we talk with New York City Police Detective Dave Fitzpatrick. Last September 11th, he flew over Manhattan, documenting the devastation below. His photos are collected in the new book, Above Hallowed Ground. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how September 11th changed our language.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. As the World Trade Center burned and fell on September 11th, my guest, New York Police Detective David Fitzpatrick, flew above Ground Zero in a police helicopter taking pictures. His photos and those of other members of the New York City Police Department are collected in the new book, Above Hallowed Ground. Fitzpatrick retired from the NYPD a couple of weeks ago after 21 years on the force. He had been a member of the Technological Assistance Response Unit and worked on many hostage crises. He often took pictures on the job. I asked him about his mission in the helicopter on September 11th.
I just went up to document it. I have my cameras with me all the time. Again, my unit's a tech unit, so we have all kinds of equipment, but I do a lot of photography, so I keep it in my car like a doctor's bag. So I went straight to... So my purpose was to document it. I wasn't really told to do that, but I just know that from years past, I've documented things. So I wanted to go up and take a look and document it. And plus, the pilot may have had their reasons to go up by checking out the skies, make sure nobody else was around, clearing out the personal traffic.
Now, you got to the World Trade Center just after the second tower was hit. What were you expecting might happen next?
I never dreamed they would come down. I don't think anybody did. When it looked bad, of course, and I knew it was terrible. I could see people on the ground trying to evacuate the area, and I could see what looked like people going into the building. It's just a lot of activity on the ground, but I had no idea at that moment. I got there just before they came down, so I really had no idea. When they came down, it was off guard. I never knew either one of them was going to come down when they did.
When the towers collapsed, could you see that they were collapsing, or did you just see smoke and not know what
was happening?
Oh,
no, I could see them collapsing. They were coming down in stations, almost like floors coming on top of one another, just coming straight down.
What else could you see from your view?
Well, when they first came down, you could just see all the rubble and how the vastness of the smoke just enveloped the whole area and just creeped along like lava. It would just keep going up towards the ocean, towards the roadways. I could see people fleeing on the ground. And, they came down almost kind of slow in a way they came. They didn't come down fast. It seems like they came down kind of slow.
Was it frightening to be in the sky not knowing if there were any other attacks that were going to happen?
No, I was not nervous at all. I was aware that that was a possibility. I did feel that there was another target. I thought maybe the Statue of Liberty would be hit, and I thought the Empire State Building would be hit, the United Nations. I think we were all on guard. We didn't talk much in the helicopter. We were just too engrossed in what we were doing. But I did feel that it was, I guess, almost imminent that things would happen by other aircraft.
Can you choose one or two of the photos that you took from the helicopter on September 11th that mean the most to you now?
Yes. The picture of the rubble. I don't know if you need a page number or whatever, but I had so many companions, so many partners in the police department that were on the ground and experienced, with an inch of their lives of the building coming down, how they described to me the smoke, and they couldn't see. They thought it was Armageddon. They thought they were all going to die. When they saw my pictures of how much smoke engulfed the area, they felt that now they could show, see, this is where I was. I was under that. And I got a lot of feedback from that from people. So that's important to me, that it enabled a little closure for people to show what the area was like, not from inside the rubble, but from outside the cocoon. So that was one photograph that means something to me. The other photograph that means a lot to me is the rescue of Sergeant McLachlan, because we had just experienced the most devastating thing in history, and certainly to everyone who was alive at the scene. In all our lives, this represented the most horrific thing that could have happened. But here we have a possibility of somebody being alive. There is somebody alive 30 feet under the rubble who was found and just spent 22 hours under the rubble. And it felt good to be a part of that, because it was a great ordeal trying to get him out over the vastness of the rubble. And it felt good because not only did I document it, but afterward I brought photographs to his house and I met his family. And for the first time, he saw what he experienced from a point that he never saw it. He was on a gurney when they took him out. So he never experienced visually seeing it until he saw my photograph. So that was pretty memorable for myself. It felt rewarding that, and also to everybody there, it was a little bit of positiveness because we got somebody out alive.
In that series of photos, there's a picture you took of a doctor standing by with an amputation kit.
Yes.
In case the sergeant's legs needed to be amputated in order to get him out of the rubble. That wasn't necessary, was it?
No, but they thought that was, because he was pinned so tightly under the ground, they had thought that when they removed him, he would start bleeding, that they would have to amputate, but it turns out they didn't have to.
What kind of shape is he in now?
He walks on two walkers, two canes. Yeah, it's mostly his feet now, but it's been almost a year now, and he still has to walk with the two arm workers to try to get by. But he doesn't give up. He keeps plugging away, and he's doing great. Now he's got a wife and kids. It's pretty nice to feel that he made it out. And when he was under the ground, his perception was that the buildings never even came down. He thought, his perception was, funny how everybody has different perceptions. He was in the level below. Most of the guys with him were killed. Him and another guy survived, and they thought it was a car bomb that went off above them. You know, they thought it was a car bomb. So when the building came down from their level, they didn't see the buildings. They were in the level below. When the building came down, they ran for cover. And again, their perception was it was a car bomb. Him and the other officer were trapped, and the third officer was uninjured. The rest of the officers were killed. And so the officer who was uninjured started to remove the rubble from one of the officers. And when the second building came down, which their perception was it was another car bomb on the floor above, it killed that officer who was uninjured, had killed him, and now just the two remaining officers are left. And in the course of the night, the heat was so intense that all the cops who were killed in the level below, their ammunition started to go off. So here the two officers, the sergeant and his partner, they felt that we're never getting out of here. Not only is there car bombs, but there's a firefight going on upstairs. They interpreted it as being a terrorist attack on the level above because they could hear the shots going off, not knowing it was their dead comrades who had just been killed. So it was quite an ordeal thinking that they were going to be the next victims or just what had happened. And it wasn't until he was removed, and there's nothing. He told me when, by looking at my pictures, when they removed him, he couldn't figure out why it was taking so long to get to the street. Because he didn't know the buildings were down. They had to carry him over the wreckage of the buildings for several hundred yards to get him out. But he couldn't figure out why it was that way because he didn't know they were down. You know, so it was interesting to hear his side of the story based on my photographs. You know, so that was pretty good.
My guest is Detective David Fitzpatrick. His photos of September 11th, taken from a police helicopter, are included in the new book, Above Hallowed Ground. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Detective David Fitzpatrick. On September 11th, he flew over Ground Zero in a police helicopter taking pictures. His aerial photos and those taken by other members of the NYPD are collected in the new book, Above Hallowed Ground. Did you lose a lot of friends in the force on the 11th?
Several, yes, a couple guys. I didn't know most of them. Some of the emergency service guys I've worked with, I knew their faces. One fellow used to be in my unit and had transferred out. And he was killed. So, you know, there was enough of them that, you know, even a fireman or two in my town, Rockville Center, 40 people had perished from my town. So, you know, all in all, it hits home. My wife's also a detective, and she worked at the morgue the whole time. So between the two of us, we knew, you know, quite a few.
What was she doing at the morgue?
She categorized the body parts. She assisted the ME. She used to be a medical photographer before she became in the police department. So since she had experience with the medical field, she volunteered to go there. Because all the cops in the whole city were basically on 12-hour shifts or plus, you know, maybe 18. So I guess everybody would take a stint down at the morgue, but she volunteered to stay there since she had experience at it and could handle it, basically. So, you know, she did that for quite a while with me being at Ground Zero every day. You know, but that's what really affected everybody. My wife, again, being a cop, I have a 10-year-old son who bounced around from neighbor's house to relative's house for weeks after that. So just it tied into how everybody was affected, not just us, but all the families.
How did you divide your allegiance between job and family during that time? The work that you and your wife were doing were really important to the police force and to the nation. At the same time, you know, you don't want to leave your son to others at a time when he was probably feeling really emotionally vulnerable and very scared.
He was scared. He thought I was killed. When he got off the school bus, he told my wife, who was home still, he told my wife, he got off the bus and said, "Dad's dead," you know, kind of thing. And my wife had to assure him that, well, she didn't know at that point. But he stood tall, as I think all kids did. You know, there's a lot of heroes in all this. It's not just the firemen and the cops and, of course, the victims, but it's my 10-year-old son with other 10-year-old kids who made their parents feel secure enough not to worry. And my son fell in with that, that he knew he had a job. Even at his age, he was 9 at the time, he knew he had a job to do, and he felt he made us comfortable knowing we had to do what we had to do.
You've been taking photographs most of your life.
Yeah.
When you were in the helicopter on September 11th, were you thinking at all about how to frame the shots, or were you just like working on instinct?
Well, it was instinct, but I'm always conscious of framing my shots. You know, knowing to go vertical, trying to keep the horizon straight. That's just built in, that I always check myself. Even though it's done second nature, I try to make my own mental checklist to frame it right, because otherwise you'll miss, you know, a portion of what you have to get.
How many rolls of film did you go through on the 11th?
Oh, boy, quite a few. I brought about 60 with me, 60 or 70 rolls with me. I always try to keep my camera bag ready, and so I shot. I don't count. I just shoot, so I had quite a few with me. I don't really know how many I took, but I took a lot.
Right. You've taken a lot of pictures for the New York police. You were on the hostage negotiation team for
yes.
a long time. How did mm-hmm. you use your photographs for hostage negotiations?
Well, it's a team effort. It's not just the camera. It's just mm-hmm. not the negotiator. Mm-hmm. Each piece is used. I would say many of the jobs, many, and we have quite a few over the years, that the camera enables them to know the precise moment to enter the apartment, break the door in and get the guy. It's based on visually seeing where he is that aids many of those times. So it's proportionally, it's quite a high number that the camera does help.
How have you used your camera for surveillance?
Well, we do a lot of surveillance. You know, we'll have to go to various locations to do surveillance, either through vans or stakeout areas or from windows or roofs, you know, all different areas I've done surveillance.
And what are some of the clever places you've hidden yourself to take pictures so that you won't be seen by anybody else as you're collecting evidence?
Well, I've been in boxes on the street, you know, through hallway windows that you put up a construction site, through various things I can't even tell you that we use to hide ourselves. You know, I've done, you know, all aspects of hiding over the last 18 years. To get it, but that's what you have to do.
Have you had to learn how to be really quiet and breathe really quietly when you're hiding?
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And not and have everything ready, so if you need something, you don't have to fumble looking for it. You can't, if you're inside a van, you have to make sure the van don't move if somebody's leaning against the van, you know, while you're inside. So it's a lot of things like that you have to learn to do.
What are some of the technical developments that have happened while you've worked for the police that have enabled you to expand what you can do in documenting and collecting visual evidence?
Well, it's not always with the 35mm camera. We use, actually, the medical industry has helped quite a bit, because if somebody holds somebody hostage, just say, inside a building, let's say a guy robs a store and he runs and flees into a building, you know, we never try to let the perpetrator know he has somebody hostage. That's a word we'll never use. But we have to try to assess where he is in the apartment, and if he, in fact, because a lot of times he'll be trapped in there. And when we try to get him out, he'll say, you know, "Oh, I'm going to kill these two people. I have a gun. You know, if you come with me, they're going to die," kind of thing. So we try to visually and audio-wise see what he does. So we'll have fiber optics to try to maybe drill holes in the wall or lower a camera down to see inside, because it's important for us to know if he's in the kitchen boiling something on the stove, if he's hiding in the basement, if he does have two people, maybe he has four people, maybe he has nobody in there. So we try to determine all that with the cameras, and the medical industry has helped quite a bit with their fiber optics. So we were able to get some of those. And a lot of the stuff's made in-house. We have the police department's loaded with guys who are super talented, really are. They take the job to heart. They use their own money many times to come up with an idea and actually devise little things to help us. So you can lower a camera in, and it'll be so small that you can't see it from his point of view. So, yeah, it has a lot of advances.
You mentioned you have to know if the hostage taker is boiling something on the stove. Why did you use that image?
Well, because that kind of thing is something, it's like a checklist of things we always have to watch, because the stove is an area, the kitchen is an area where there's knives, there's all kinds of instruments in there. If he was unarmed when he fled, he could now be armed if he's in the kitchen.
Armed even with boiling water?
Boiling water, sure. A pot or some hot substance, anything like that could be a danger for the entry guys who eventually go in, or for the victims themselves. So you want to try to know that, so we can give the heads up to the guys, if and when they come into the apartment, just what they have to, maybe watch for. Maybe we want to know if the victims are in the bedroom and now the perpetrator is in the kitchen, or he's in the other bedroom. Maybe it's at that point that we'll want to know when to go in on him. So that's why it's very important that we use those cameras to see that.
Is there a time when your photos or your images really saved the day?
Well, every time a cop's happy, that saves the day for me. When he walks away and he sees, like I said, that he sees something, that saves the day. But yes, I photograph many people who are wanted for homicide, so that they would use the photographs and from a photo array identify the person. So yeah, that in a way saves the day, sure.
Your September 11th photos and photos of Ground Zero are collected in the book Above Hallowed Ground. What else have you done with your photos? You've said that you've given the photos to survivors and their families, to police officers. Are any of these photos hanging around your house, or these images that you want to wake up to and see through the day?
I've never not looked at them. September 11th has never left my day. Since September 11th, it's not a day goes by that I'm not involved with it at some point. So I have none hanging in my house, no. Someday maybe, but to me, it's still doing the work to have the work seen by people. So no, I don't have any hanging anywhere. I guess maybe I'm not up to that point yet, because it's still all fresh to me. I'm still working on stuff. It's a whole year later, and it's as fresh to me as the day it happened, because it's not a day goes by that I don't look at the images each and every day for one reason or another. So I have none hanging in my home at all.
Are you doing anything special on September 11th?
It's funny you say that. I've thought a lot about that. I just don't know yet. I'm almost seeing that as the day I could finally take a break from it. That's how I kind of see that day. I don't know how I feel. Even thinking about it now, I just feel like it's the day I'll make a decision on which way I'm going to go about it.
A private day or a day to participate in more public?
Yeah. I don't know if I'll do things public. I feel I have to talk to myself that day on September 11th, at least in the morning maybe,
Mm-hmm.
Then maybe the rest of the day will go straight, but right now I feel I have to, that's like my guidepost. That's the end of the line for me, maybe I know I have a commitment to myself and really to the world to look at the pictures, and I feel September 11th is that day that's been achieved, I guess. So I'll see how I feel that day.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you.
David Fitzpatrick's aerial photos of Ground Zero, taken September 11th, along with the aerial photos of other members of the NYPD, are collected in the new book Above Hallowed Ground. Fitzpatrick retired from the force last month. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg has been listening to Americans struggling to find the words to describe September 11th. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. As the anniversary of 9/11 approaches, a lot of people have been looking to see how the attack has affected the language. But according to our linguist Jeff Nunberg, they've been looking in the wrong places.
Over the last few weeks, there's been a spate of articles on the effects that the 9/11 attacks have had on the language. I can see where that would seem an obvious subject. If 9/11 meant that everything was different, then you'd figure we'd be talking differently, too. As a writer in the New York Times put it, the words of 9/11 remain chiseled into the language. But the language isn't really like the Vietnam Memorial. It doesn't permanently record every momentous public event in stone. There are a lot of words that have been more prominent since the attack, some old and some recycled: ground zero, weaponized, sleeper cell, evildoer, homeland security. But apart from 9/11 itself, these are mostly news crawl words that aren't likely to take up permanent residence in our everyday speech. I hear a lot of people using jihad these days, but then a decade or so ago, I was hearing everybody use that mother of all battles formula. The fact is that world events only have a big effect on the language when they transform the daily lives of millions of Americans, the way World War II did. That war made dozens of contributions to our ordinary vocabulary, from beachhead, blockbuster, and bloodbath to firepower, flak, and foxhole. And even the comparatively limited conflict in Vietnam popularized items like hawks and doves, grunt, and boat people, not to mention memorable euphemisms like friendly fire and collateral damage. But I wouldn't look for similar effects from 9/11, or at least not unless we find ourselves in a long and messy ground war in Iraq. The attacks and their aftermath are still weighing on our minds, but people's daily preoccupations have returned to pretty much what they were before. In fact, one post-9/11 phrase that's already disappeared is, "That's so September 10th. Or as the ad for Southwest Airlines says, "Business travel is back." And yet the attacks have left some traces in the way we talk, if you look for them in the right places. On a hunch, I went to check how the newspapers were using that problematic word enormity in the months immediately following the attacks. I say problematic because this is one of those words that the usage mavens are always getting shirty about. The traditional rule says that you're only supposed to use enormity to refer to things that are monstrously evil or horrible, like Jeffrey Dahmer's crimes, not just for things of great size, like a 747 or Bill Gates' fortune. Now, in the great debates over usage, I tend to side with the noncombatants. But I confess that it still bothers me to hear enormity used as a synonym for huge. For a long time, I used to do an inward double take when I saw somebody referring to the enormity of Joe DiMaggio's impact on the game of baseball. I mean, that's something I wouldn't even say about George Steinbrenner. But at a certain point, it struck me that all those double takes were probably giving me a stiff neck. Back in 2000, I looked at 100 citations for enormity from a database of major newspapers and found that only about a third of them actually use the word to refer to horrible or monstrous things. When the tide is going that much against you on a question of usage, it's usually a good idea to abandon ship. Even William Safire has thrown in the towel on enormity. But it turns out that the old sense of enormity made a big comeback in the 3 months after 9/11. The word was 5 times as frequent as it was in the previous 3 months, and writers were using it correctly 80% of the time, particularly when they were talking about the attacks. That makes sense to me. In the weeks right after the attacks, people were groping for words to do justice to their anger and shock. A lot of politicians and journalists were using language that suggested an almost Victorian sense of indignation: despicable, dastardly, nefarious. But it turned out that the word that conveyed the exact mix of outrage and wickedness and horror was sitting right at hand all along, even if people had half forgotten that it was there. It was like suddenly needing a pie plate you hadn't seen in years, then remembering you'd been using it under a potted plant. And the revival of enormity hasn't shown any signs of fading since then. When I looked at press stories from this summer, writers were still using the word correctly about 2/3 of the time, even in connection with things that have nothing to do with 9/11, like the AIDS crisis in Africa or the wave of child kidnappings. For a moment at least, the attack seemed to have reawakened people's sense of what enormity really means, or I should probably say, what enormity really is. My first instinct would be to say that this won't last. Sooner or later, enormity will go back to being a word that people use mostly to describe things like baseball stadiums. But then I recall how an attack on the U.S. more than 60 years ago breathed new life into another moribund word, infamy. Maybe we should measure the effects of an event not by the new words it introduces, but by the old ones it reminds us to use more carefully.
Jeff Nunberg is currently a fellow at the Stanford Humanities Center. He's the author of the book, The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Today is the 75th birthday of drummer Elvin Jones. We'll close with his 1964 recording with John Coltrane, A Love Supreme.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the Discovery Channel, presenting a documentary based on the New York Times series, Portraits of Grief, Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern and Pacific on the Discovery Channel. And Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of The Art of Forgiveness, Loving Kindness, and Peace by Jack Kornfield, author of A Path with Heart. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Paul Auster about his new novel, The Book of Illusions. The main character is an English professor who has lost his family in a plane crash. To distract himself from his grief, he writes a book about a forgotten silent film star who mysteriously disappeared. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.